Chapters 1 to 8 of Mark's Gospel occur in and around Galilee, in what's now northern Israel. In chapters 8 to 10, Jesus and his disciples are depicted as constantly travelling. Discipleship is learned on the way. Chapters 11 to 16, the final section of the Gospel, occur in and around the city of Jerusalem, and particularly its temple precinct. Biblical scholar Bonnie Thurston remarks that this sequence represents a great irony, a great Markan irony. For most Jews in first century Palestine, the temple in Jerusalem was the place you went preeminently to meet with God. Conventionally speaking, then, this narrative trajectory looks as though it depicts the movement of Jesus and his disciples towards the holiest place in the land. But by this stage in the gospel story, it's become clear that for Jesus, Jerusalem signifies a place of religious corruption rather than holiness. A place of personal rejection and death. The religious authorities and the conflicts have been intensifying in recent chapters. They've been unable to recognise that he has come from God. And so in today's passage, Jesus enacts his final separation from the temple cult. Mark expresses it with characteristic economy, saying, "He came out of the temple. He left the building." Well, theologically, various things can be drawn from this. One scholar says the gospel is concerned to relocate believers' devotional focus from the temple as a place to prayer as a practice. This may seem relatively uncontroversial to us, but it must have been a big deal in Jesus' day. For although the temple he knew, the second temple, wasn't nearly as large or splendid as Solomon's, it had recently been refurbished by King Herod the Great and was the centre of Jerusalem's life. And like Mark, the Jewish historian Josephus mentions the mammoth size of its stones, reporting that they were white and 37 feet long, 12 feet high, and 18 feet wide. "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." But Jesus is unimpressed. "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." Well, as a matter of historical fact, this was true. The temple would be destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, around the time the Gospel of Mark was written. And there's a whole scholarly literature on about whether this was really a prediction or whether it had already happened, and, you know. But spiritually speaking, Jesus' words resonate with his general insistence that his disciples not be too attached to established religious forms. And though he never preached a systematic disregard for the law of Israel, Jesus was clearly concerned that things like temple worship and conventions like Sabbath observance and the purity codes had been co-opted to serve the ends of those in power. Rather than making visible the character of God and enabling human connection with God, he sees these practices functioning to block access and burden those least able to bear the cost. He quotes the prophets, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Again and again, Jesus points to the God who will not be contained or controlled by religious language, rituals, or buildings. This might suggest that the promised destruction of the temple is for Jesus an act of God, a judgment on the corruption of the temple system. And the disciples seem to hear his words this way. They ask him privately, "Tell us, when will this be? And when will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" And at first glance, Jesus seems to reply within the same framework of apocalyptic violence. He catalogues a whole series of disasters about to befall, wars and rumours of wars, nation rising against nation, earthquakes and famines. And yet, strikingly, he warns his disciples not to make any of this mean too much. "Don't be alarmed," he says, "and don't think these catastrophes are signs of some imminent end." As Jean-Pierre Dupuy puts it, Jesus refuses to let himself be carried away by millenarian fervour. He not only desacralises the temple, that is, makes the temple not this kind of untouchable holy place, but he also desacralises the event of its destruction, denying that that has any particular divine significance. And according to theologian James Allison, the import of Jesus' teaching here is twofold. To begin, he's decoupling our image of God from violence and mayhem. He's subverting our tendencies to attribute divine meaning to disaster and so to become morbidly fascinated by it. In this passage, Jesus describes events that do likely refer to the fall of Jerusalem, which was a terrible thing for those who suffered it. But not even that, he says, for all its horror is to be read in a theological key. For Jesus insists, if anyone says to you at that time, "Look, here is the Messiah," or "Look, there he is," do not believe it. Allison writes, the disciples must learn to distance themselves from attributing theological importance to the violent events of this world. They have no such importance. And it follows then that what Jesus really cares about is teaching his disciples how to dwell amidst the violent cataclysms of history and how to keep faith with the much slower work of transformation being wrought in our world by the love of God. Well, these are themes we've touched on before at Benedictus, but they seem worth revisiting at this historical moment. For we too, it seems, live in a time of collapsing temples and tottering institutions, of unbridled warfare and manifest disorder in the natural world. In the chaos and confusion of this time, there are those on both the right and left of politics who seem determined to hasten the demolition of structures we've built in the name of bringing about some definitive shift in the world's affairs. Others are convinced of the need to defend and maintain these structures, seeing them, perhaps despite their limitations, as our only real bulwark against chaos, tyranny, and the war of all against all. Some purport to see in the triumph of certain nations and individuals the hand of God acting directly to consummate divine purpose, while others insist that these are false readings, false prophets, false messiahs whose only interest is themselves. Our passage from Mark is known in the literature as the Little Apocalypse. And if our times feel a little apocalyptic, then I wonder what wisdom we might glean from it. If it's true that Jesus instructs his disciples that what matters most in such a time of tribulation is not getting hung up by the sound and fury, but our capacity to continue to recognise and participate in the deeper dynamics of creation and reconciliation, then what might this suggest practically about how to live in such times? So I'm going to offer three words. First, risk. Jesus does not pretend that living in alignment with the work and will of God in violent times will be risk-free. Indeed, quite the opposite. As for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings because of me. It may be even worse than that. Brother will betray brother to death, and you will be hated by all because of my name. Mark is writing to a small early Christian community facing persecution on account of the gospel. But it's not hard to recognise the same risk being run by officials and military officers who may be called to stand against the abuse of executive power in the US. And by whistleblowers, dissidents, journalists and peacemakers the world over, who, as well as facing the violence of those in power, may also suffer the rejection of their families and friends and all the agony of doubt that entails. For in times of chaos and collapse, knowing what to remain true to, exactly when and how to resist, and when and how to let things go and be destroyed, well, all that can be agonisingly unclear. And this brings me to my second word, discernment. To remain true to the slow action of love in a troubled world requires the capacity to listen deeper. Jesus speaks of listening for the prompting of the Holy Spirit. When they bring you to trial and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but say whatever is given you at that time, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. This deepened listening is much more open textured than adopting some pre-packaged stance of either the left or the right, letting the rules of my tribe determine and justify my choices. If we're truly seeking to discern the way of God, then that's risky too. We're doing our best to sift the possibilities and be responsible. But such discernment does not necessarily culminate in the assurance of our righteousness. Again and again, we must come back to the ground of listening. Be open, humble, attentive, and exposed. Which leads to my final word, endurance. Jesus says, "The one who endures to the end will be saved." The Greek word is hypomeno, and it means steadfastness under trial and opposition. It has connotations of patience and of waiting, but it's no passive stoicism. It's more an active, hopeful, expectant waiting on God. Hypomeno is about actively orienting ourselves to the good and persevering in the face of violence and uncertainty, suffering and injustice. It's about keeping faith with the possibility of the world's transformation. Wherever we face a little apocalypse, whether in our families and our workplaces, or in the breakdown of social and political structures, discipleship means being there in the midst as Christ is in our midst. In Jesus, God has entered time and wills to liberate and heal. Look out for that reality. Be ready to participate in it.